Hi, and welcome back to the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm your host, Maddie Alm, registered dietitian and former professional runner. Today's guest is Kara Goucher. Kara's from Minnesota, and she went on to run for the University of Colorado, where she was a three-time NCAA champion. After college, Kara went pro and was a five-time member of Team USA, including a two-time Olympian in 2008 in the 10K and 2012 in the marathon. She was also the 2007 World Championship silver medalist in the 10K. Kara transitioned to the marathon, where she was a top five finisher at New York City Marathon and twice at Boston. And while in New York, she was the first podium finish for an American in 15 years. She was also the fourth place finisher at the 2016 US Olympic Trials. Kara is the author of The Longest Race, sharing her experience with Nike Oregon Project and coach Alberto Salazar. She's also co-host of the podcast Nobody Asked Us with Des Linden, and she's mom to Colt Goucher and wife to Adam Goucher. They live in Boulder, Colorado. I hope you enjoy today's episode with Kara. All right, Kara, thank you so much for being on the Fueling Forward podcast. I'm so excited to talk with you today.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and we share the CU experience, runners at CU, under the same coaches, which is really fun. And so, I'm just really excited to have you here. You have such an inspiring story. And May, I'm trying to feature some moms who run, and you've done a lot of amazing advocate work in that community as well. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yes. So let's just get started by having you tell us a bit about who you are and how you got into the sport of running.
I would say I am a person who loves running. Yes, I'm a mom and a wife. My son is 14 and my husband is also a runner. Now I'm kind of like mom, cheerleader. I host a podcast and I work for NBC and they're on their broadcasting team for track and field. So that's kind of how I describe myself now. And I got into running. I didn't get into serious running really until college, but I got into running at age six. My grandpa took me to my first race. So my grandpa was a lifelong runner, but he wasn't a racer, which I always like to point that out because he wasn't obsessed with like getting a 5K time or anything like that. He just really loved running. And as I got older, he talked about how, he ran into his 80s and he talked about how it made him feel calm and it made him feel centered. And so he was the one that introduced me to running. No one else in my family was a runner until he introduced me to it.
Wow. I love that running for him meant so much more than times. I think that's rare to have that experience or see that modeled so early in life and just see like running can be something that adds to my life, brings me joy. My grandpa was the same way. He ran a mile every day until he passed away in his late 70s. So I can definitely relate to that.
Yeah, like we would go to a race once or twice a year. Like we would go to like a fun run, the Life Run, the Mother's Day Run, whatever. And then maybe a couple times in the summer we'd run to the Minuet, which when I was a kid seemed so far, but it's like not even a mile and a half away. And then he'd buy me a soda and we'd walk back to his house. So I started running young, but it was literally like four or five times a year. You know what I mean? So like when people say, "Oh, you started so young," I'm like, I realized that running was a thing, but it really was just something that my grandpa and I did together.
Yeah, it was just a special way to spend time with people you love, which at the end of the day, isn't that what running is anyway?
That's great. Yeah, for sure. And I feel grateful that that was my intro to it because it was so like innocent. And then obviously it grew from there. I ended up running for my middle school and then I started ran for my middle school in cross country. And then from there, I got invited to go out to the high school for track. So I ran for the same coach from seventh grade through my senior year, which was really special because he's just a great guy. And, obviously it grew from there and then I went to Colorado. But yeah, it started really, really pure.
Yeah. When did it turn into something more serious for you? When did you kind of realize, oh, I could be really good at this?
My sophomore year, there's this other really good Olympian from Minnesota named Carrie Tolfson, and her parents told my parents when I was a sophomore about this thing called Foot Locker. And so I went to the regional championships. I think they were in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and I qualified and I got flown out to San Diego. And Maddie, it was like crazy. Wow. Like I got to the room and I'm like, there was another girl in the room and at the hotel. And I'm like, oh, who are our other two roommates? Just assuming we had to share beds.
Yeah.
And she's like, we don't have to share beds. We get our own beds. And so I couldn't believe that this was like a thing, you know? And then it was, was on ESPN. So I got, like, that was my first inkling of, like, oh, this could be something. Like, I could go somewhere with this. But I still was doing a lot of other things. I was still in competitive dance, and I still played soccer, and I was a competitive skier. So it was, like, one of many things I did. But I definitely, that was the first time I realized, like, oh, I could be, maybe I could be good at this.
And you got to, like, live a life of pure luxury.
Yeah, yes, I did. In the middle of winter, you know, in Duluth, I went to San Diego. And before that, I had always been obsessed with the Olympics, obsessed. And my sister used to tear out, you know, like, pictures from, she got Sports Illustrated from a really young age. She's like a total sports nerd. So I had, like, Carl Lewis and FloJo and Jackie Joyner Kersee in my room. And I wanted to be a sprinter. But then as I started to get older, I realized, like, I'm not that fast. And so she would, like, save articles on Lynn Jennings. And so that Lynn Jennings was also someone that I really looked up to. And so, but I still didn't really understand, like, what, I did not know what professional running really was until I was at CU.
Yeah, I honestly, I didn't either. I had a similar experience where I didn't know anything about, like, one of my teammates in high school was a big fan of Jenny Berenger at the time, Jenny Simpson now. And I was like, who's that? What do you mean? had no idea how big the sport could be. So it's always fun to hear about, you know, elite runners when they realize the sport. And I think people are often surprised to hear that it's maybe not as early as they think. And it's not something where you're specializing from an early age. And I think that's, you know, you and I have talked about this recently, talking about mileage in high school and how both of us were kind of in the 30s. So as someone who's been at the top level of the sport, what advice could you give to a young runner who maybe feels behind or feels like they need to do more to keep up with their peers?
I mean, that's the beauty of running, is that you're never really behind. You're just on your own timeline. You know, I have an eighth grade son, and we don't let him run more than, like, 12 miles a week. And I know that that is so little. And I know that when I was in eighth grade, I ran more than that. But I just think he has his whole life to choose to pursue it. And I think, you know, Adam won, he won Foot Locker when he was in high school off of 30 miles a week. I qualified twice off of 30 miles a week. And it really allowed me to choose the sport and then really develop in it when I was ready, to actually choose it, you know? And so I think sometimes with, like, social media and all these different outlets now where kids can see what other kids are doing, they do feel like they're behind or they haven't run a certain time. But the reality is, like, you don't have to do it right now. You have, like, this whole arc of a career to actually do that and to figure out if you really want to do it and then grow with the sport.
Absolutely. And giving your body, your mind kind of space to grow and do its own thing is only going to help in the long run if you want to stay in the sport and ultimately get to a higher level. So I'm curious for you, you know, growing up in the Midwest, like, what was that like for you from a food standpoint? What was your relationship with food like growing up in your family?
I'm actually really grateful that I grew up the way I did. Like, I didn't know, I mean, obviously we could have eaten healthier because I had never heard of organic or anything until I went to college. But, like, food was an important part of the day. Like, we all sat at the table together. You had to clean your plate. There was no weirdness around food. You know, my mom made hearty meals. We all ate it. I'm so glad that that was my background, because as I progressed through running, I saw more and more, you know, eating disorder centered around running. I mean, I had a teammate that was like that. When I went to Foot Locker, I saw other athletes that were like that. And especially in college, you know, and I definitely had a bad period with food. It was only about 6 months in college. I had gotten second at the NCAA. And I thought, like, what do I need to do to, like, become NCAA champion? And just so foolishly, I just started really restricting my diet and counting calories. And it was such short term. Like, I got better for a little bit. And then I just was injured. And I ended up being injured for, like, 3 years. And so I learned that the hard way. But I think because I had a background of, like, and even my family during that time was like, we're worried about you. Eat, you know? So my family was really supportive always and had such a healthy relationship with food. And I think that even though I did struggle for a little bit, that foundation was always there, that I was always able to go back to that.
Absolutely. That foundation with food, you know, that healthy relationship, safe environment around mm-hmm. food from a young age is so protective. And it's very normal for runners and athletes in general to go through periods where they struggle with their relationship with food, especially being in a new environment. So for you, it sounds like that was the case transitioning from high school to college. What was that like? What did that progression from having that healthy relationship with food to struggling look like for you?
You know, it was like a slow over time. My freshman year, I was still totally normal around food. You know, like even though I would see other people not or being, you know, questioning some of my choices, but I just grew up like you just ate when you were hungry and you didn't worry about it. And it was kind of a slow burn where I would say the time where I had like I don't want to say like I had this huge food issue, but I was restricting. You know, my sophomore year, I got second at the NCAA championships in the 3000. And I thought, I mean, here's like an easy thing I can do to like take that next jump. And so I started restricting my junior year. And again, like there was some, like, I was excited. I'd never been called skinny. I mean, all these crazy things, mm-hmm. but I very quickly, you know, like my mom and actually Coach Wetmore were like, you can't keep doing this. Like, you're going to get hurt. And so I gained weight for my senior year, but I still ended up getting hurt after that by the end of my senior year because of all the, you just can't treat your body like that. Like, there's a consequence that comes. So I was able to win cross country my senior year, but then I ended up getting some stress fractures and having some issues. And it was because of this like 6 month period where I was super restrictive with food in it. And I was kind of in and out of injuries for like 3 years after that until I finally overcame it. And so it kind of, yeah, like when I first got there, I didn't even think about changing my diet, but it was just like over 2 or 3 years, I kind of started to look around and yeah, and thought that was the answer. And it clearly wasn't. I mean, I lost 3 years of a career because I was foolish for 6 months.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's easy to say like, oh, I was being foolish, but also that's what a lot of athletes think is right. And I think that's what's so hard about nutrition is there's not a lot of, and especially I think then, like they hired their first dietitian when I was a junior. And so we didn't even have any of those resources initially in college. And I think, you know, when you were there too, there was probably even less when it came to nutrition support. And athletes, I have this conversation all the time where it's that you don't realize how long of an impact those choices have. And if you knew that's where you were going, you never would have done that in the first place. And that's a really big purpose of this podcast is to help highlight those stories of, look, I tried that and here's what happened. It's kind of, you know, a lesson to be learned. There is long-term damage, even just from 6 months of underfueling. Mm-hmm. We can see decrease in bone density and increased risk for bone-related injuries, which you experience. So kind of reflecting back, what do you feel like were some of the early signs that you had started to struggle? Maybe when would it have been beneficial for you to have some help?
Yeah, you know, it's so funny you mentioned that because I don't ever remember meeting a nutritionist or anything like that. Yeah. And I just remember going home for the summer and my mom saying, what's going on here? And then I came back in the fall and Coach Wetmore was like, this, you got to start eating better. But there wasn't like this plan of, we're going to send you to this person and they're going to talk to you. And I think because I had that foundation of healthy eating as a child, I was able to get back to that. But during that time, it was obvious that I was restricting, you know, and it would have been great if I had someone to talk to or even just someone to bounce it off of, like, hey, I just got second in the nation. I want to be a champion. What do I need to do? Like, could I be fueling better? Because I probably could have. I could have been taking protein after a workout. I could have been hydrating better. But I didn't know that kind of stuff, right? So my thing was like, well, I'm just not going to eat anything that's bad for me. But that's a slippery slope because all of a sudden you can kind of convince yourself that everything's bad for you. So yeah, I think if I had just had the resources from the beginning, it would have been better. And then even when I was coming out of it, because I had lost a lot of weight, it was like if I had had better resources even then, I think it would have been better when I was coming out of it instead of just being like, you took it too far, get better, you know, right. Like, okay. Yeah. And I mean, it was seriously like, I didn't get injured right away, but I got injured. I would say I got better. I won cross country, But then I got injured shortly after that. And then I seriously was in a 3-year cycle. And like, it was so frustrating because at that point I was healthy again. I was taking care of myself. But I just, looking back, it's like crazy how much damage I did in such a short amount of time.
Absolutely. And you just highlighted such an important point, which is the first place runners' minds go is what should I take out instead of what should I add in? And being more experienced and knowing that more, now you said, oh, I should have added in protein after my run. I should have added in more fluids, more hydration. But then it's easy to jump to, well, if I take something out, that's what's really going to help me. That's going to make me better. Not realizing that you're taking away, especially things like sugar, you're taking away a lot of your carbs, you're taking away that main source of fuel, which is really what starts to have that impact on, you know, bone density and hormone health and all those kinds of things. And the other piece to that, like you mentioned earlier, the body image piece, losing weight and feeling like, oh, someone's calling me skinny. I think a lot of us align that with, that means I look like a runner. That means I'm going to be faster.
Right.
And you experienced, after some weight restoration, you actually won cross country. And I know you dealt with injuries after that. But what did that feel like? Did that kind of help a light bulb go off for you that this wasn't the only way to do things?
Oh, for sure. I mean, like that was my ultimate dream in college, was to win the cross country championship. Like, I set that goal as a freshman after I got 180 something my freshman year. I was like, I'm going to win this someday. And that was my ultimate goal. And I can't tell you exactly how much weight I put back on, but it was like, I did look different. You could see it, you know, versus in the fall, in the spring when I was running track and I won a couple titles, it was like visually I looked different, but yet I still won on a tough day with like a really good field. You know, it was a lot of really good athletes that became Olympians in that field. And so it was like, oh, that was, I'm never doing that again, you know? And that's why it was so hard to then get injured, because it was like, oh man, I learned my lesson. I don't want to be injured. But yeah, like I was so much stronger than I was a year before when I had hoped to win and didn't, you know? So it was just, yeah, it really like solidified it for me. And then fast forward even a few years later, like I set my PR in the 5,000 during that time where I was being really restrictive with food in 2000. And fast forward 5 years later, I probably weighed almost 20 pounds more and I shattered that PR. And it was just like, oh my gosh, it's not it. You know, that was like a second time in my life where I was like, yeah, it's not about weight. It's about the work that you put in and how you treat your body. So yeah, two light bulb moments for sure.
Yeah. And I think that really fits with my personal motto, which is fueled is faster. That's always going to be the fastest version of yourself, is the fueled and strongest version. And sometimes we have to learn that the hard way, and it's a hard experience to go through. So before we kind of talk about life after college, what's one last piece of advice you could give to a collegiate athlete who maybe finds themselves tempted to follow that route, or who's currently struggling with that mindset?
I would say try to talk to someone. Ask your coach to see a nutritionist or someone that you can talk to, because, I mean, just as someone who lived it, it's not worth it, and it's not going to give you what you want. I love what you said earlier. It's about adding, not taking away. Like, if I had been able to talk to someone and they had said, hey, you're going to recover quicker from your workouts if you do this after and you add this. You're going to have a better day if you hydrate and fuel beforehand. I would have been like, okay, because I just wanted to get better, you know? And as a professional, those are the things that I did. I mean, we talked about this before we recorded. I got fourth at the Olympic trials, which was super sad in 2016, but I was 37 and a half years old, right? So I was running the best I'd ever, still continuing to run well, because I was, and I ate so much that morning and I fueled so well. And that's what I had been doing for years and like prepping my body. So yeah, I just think it really is truly usually more adding and being really mindful about those choices that help you jump to the next level. It's not about taking stuff away.
Absolutely. That's such great advice. And speaking of jumping to the next level, you really did. You ended up running professionally, and we'll kind of get into that. But what was that transition like, especially amidst some injuries? How was that transition from collegiate to professional for you?
It was terrible, Maddie.
Yeah.
I mean, I signed my contract and I was super excited. And then I spent, you know, the next 3 years, I probably raced six times. And it just felt like, what am I doing? You know, like I had applied for a postgraduate scholarship that I had gotten, and I had turned it down to run pro. You know, like signing the contract was super exciting. I grew, you know, I came up through CU with the Culpeppers right in front of me. So I saw them go pro and make Olympic teams. I saw my husband go pro and make an Olympic team. And I was so excited about it. And then my experience, like they made Olympic teams right out of college. I did not, you know. And it was just frustrating. I remember thinking, like, what am I doing with my life? Like, I would sleep in super late and, like, have Adam go to practice. And then I would cross train for, like, 2 hours. And I just remember thinking, like, this is my life. I mean, I used to be somebody. I had goals, you know. But I'm super glad that I stayed with it. Because every time I thought about quitting, I just would feel this, like, pang of regret of, like, no, just give it one more shot. So I'm glad I stuck with it. But it was a bumpy transition. I think... That's another thing people should know. Not everybody just takes that leap and just, it's not just seamless. It is for some people, but for more people than not, it's not seamless. There's, you're adjusting to a new coach, you're adjusting to a new program, you're adjusting to not having classes and having all the focus be on running, which is like a whole mental shift too. So it was not an easy transition for me.
Something I'm very passionate about in the sports performance world is conducting more research on female subjects. Most everything in sports science is based on research done on males, and then the results are applied to women with a shrink it and pink it approach. That's why I'm so excited to be partnering with Hedas to bring you today's episode. Hedas is a female-founded company that produces a high-performance footwear designed based on research done on women, so the shoe better reflects a woman's unique needs. Women have higher arches, a lower ankle bone, upward angled toenails, and a smaller, more rounded instep compared to males. Hedas shoes are both durable and breathable and fit like a glove. I've been running in them for the past couple of months and absolutely love them, and have even noticed my chronic shin splints have gone away. If you're interested in trying them out, head over to their website, www.hedas.com, that's H-E-T-T-A-S, to find out where you can get a pair today.
Yeah, that's a super hard life transition. I think transitioning out of college in general is hard. No one really talks about that. You know, it's like, oh, you're free, but then you're like, free to do what?
What
am I yeah. supposed to do?
And like, you have no more structure. You know what
you
I mean?
No, like, structure.
Yeah, college is yeah. like, you learn structure, you're learning who you are, but you still have like these boundaries, like you have to go to class and you have to go to practice or whatever. And then all of a sudden you're just like, I just signed this pro contract and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
But I'm like, how do I schedule my day? How do I do this? It was hard for me.
Yeah. It's like bowling with the bumpers and then you take the bumpers off and yes. you realize you've just been really heavily using those the entire yes. time and you so bowl true. Zero. It's a very hard transition. And I think, you know, this is something I've talked about in previous episodes of having some life balance outside of running. Was that anything that you had, or was that something that you learned that would be helpful, or what did that look like for you?
I didn't have great balance at the time because I had just married Adam and he was running really well, right? Like he was making Olympic teams, making world championship teams. And I was kind of, you know, like my closest friends were really like my high school friends. And then I wasn't living by my family. So I was kind of lonely. But the one good thing that happened during that time is that I decided to learn how to cook because Adam was the one that did all the cooking and everything. And I was like, I need purpose. I like went to Barnes & Noble and bought some cookbooks. And I was like, I'm going to teach myself how to cook. I'm going to teach myself about like food and what should I be eating and stuff like that. So that's like the one big thing that like was a major shift in my life, because now I do all the cooking for my family. I enjoy it. But that was a thing that good thing that came out of that time. Yeah. I wish I had had more, you know, I think that's another thing too, is like in high school, I always had a lot of other activities. Like I wasn't just a runner. I was also in the band and student council and played other sports. And then when I was in college, I also had school, which I loved so much. And so it, all of a sudden I was just like just a runner and I couldn't run.
Right.
And I'm just sort of like, okay. And everybody that I know is a runner of where I'm living now. And so I'm kind of like, I'm not running, I'm not training, I'm not seeing everybody. It was super isolating. So that's like one good thing that came of it is I taught myself how to cook.
Yeah. I think that's something I've found just in, like, the more elite running world. Injuries are really isolating because everyone you're around all the time are also runners. And so my friends, like, growing up in Colorado, having some friends outside of running were truly my saving grace, because it is lonely when you're going through an injury, and cross training is lonely and not a fun experience, and there's a lot there. And so I love that you were able to find cooking and kind of find something, a solo activity even, that allowed you to experience some balance outside of running. And I feel like for me, when I get into cooking, my relationship with food is just really positive. I'm just really enjoying it. It's fun to, like, put all this together and share it with people and, you know, taste all the work that you put in. So I'm curious if that's anything you experienced, your relationship with food evolving as you learned how to cook.
Oh, for sure. Like, I never thought about food as, like, fuel, you know. It was just like, oh, I just ate, I need to eat. And then I saw for the brief period, food is, like, bad. Oh, there's all these rules. Like, I can't have this, and I can't have anything fried. I can't have anything with sugar. And then it was like, I'm actually, you know, like, I mean, I was, like, so proud of myself. I was, like, roasting peppers and stuffing peppers. And, like, that's, wow. Like, let me tell you, I never ate a pepper growing up. Yeah. Okay, that's, like, not a thing that my mom was buying. And so it felt really good. And it felt really good then to help Adam, who was training so hard and who was making teams, like, for him to not have to worry about it. And it gave me kind of, like, a purpose. Not that I needed to be, like, little home wife, but, like, it gave me a purpose. Like, I'm going to go to the store and I'm going to help him stay healthy and I'm going to make this food. And it helped me appreciate, like, oh, there are things you want to get. You do want to get fiber and protein and carbohydrate. You know, like, it really changed the way I looked at food. It was great, actually. It was something really good that came from a crappy time.
Yeah. It's a really empowering experience learning about food firsthand like that. And I love that you get to try new foods when you cook. I always try to challenge myself to find a recipe that incorporates a food I've never tried or have never heard of. And you just learn a lot. And it's a really fun experience.
Yeah, it is. It can be overwhelming. But it's also, but mostly it's just really good, you know, and there were quite a few flops.
Of course.
But that's okay.
I had a few of those myself. I still remember one meal that was genuinely the worst thing I've ever made. I gagged when I took a bite and I had to throw the whole pan away. It was devastating.
that's not good.
No, but, you know, we've come a ways from that. And it sounds like eventually you did find your way back from injury. You were able to get back into the swing of things with running. You made the 2008 Olympic team. You did a lot of things at the highest level. And something that you've shared quite a bit about is your time at Nike Oregon Project and being in a really toxic environment. You've written a book about it, and there's a lot of things in there. But one thing I really want to highlight from a nutrition standpoint, you talked a bit about things like your coach calling you fat and dealing with a lot of body image and things in that environment. So what was that like, you know, going from the collegiate environment, finding your way back to a healthy place, learning how to cook and having that great relationship with food, to being thrown into this really toxic environment?
Yeah, it wasn't great. I will say, like, it was like a slow burn. Like, at first it was fun and it was exciting. And then the expectations just got so tall. And then it was like, there was just a lot of criticism and things that, like, you can't help. Like, you should have more abs. Well, I don't, you know, even when I had an eating issue, I didn't have abs like that. So just stuff that, like, literally I cannot do anything about that. And that's not going to make me run faster. If I had one more ab on each side, I am not going to run faster, you know? But I think I was a little bit older, and even though I took a lot of that brunt, I never went back to those patterns. In fact, I would eat, I mean, I was a grown woman. I was in my 30s and I would be eating in my room, like taking additional snacks because I knew I hadn't had enough at dinner. Like when we would travel as a team to training camps, I would be like, I have not had enough to eat. And so it sucked like to be told you're fat or to have like some weird thing on your body pointed out that you have no control over. But I am really proud that I didn't go back down that path. You know, like I was like, I'm not doing that to myself. I'm running. And I was no longer running whatever I was running in college. You know, I was running so much more and giving so much more time and energy to my sport. So it was like, I cannot eat less than I'm eating right now. Like I was just working out so much and so hard. I knew I have to fuel myself.
Absolutely. I think that's another thing where learning the hard way sometimes helps you in the long run if you're confronted with that again. And I think, like you said earlier, the ab thing is so true. That's something I struggled with. I don't have abs. I have never had abs in my life.
I mean, like, we have abs, but they just don't pop out like other people. Yeah,
it's not a six pack per se.
Yeah.
And that truly is a genetic. It's a genetic trait. A lot of, you know, how you build muscle, how your muscle looks on you, if you have visible six packs or not, truly is genetic. Like, my husband, Nick, has a chronic eight pack from just life. And like, that's his genetics, like, good for you. But that's not how most of us live. And it is a weird standard that I think a lot of runners have. They're like, oh, if I get this, I will be faster. And it sounds like that was also kind of the thought process coming from your coach.
Yeah, it was like, if you need to look like this, like, if you look like this, then you'll run even faster. And it's like, I'm never gonna look like that. You know, I'm 5'8". I'm never gonna be like a super, and I'm like long boned. I'm never gonna be this super tiny, like, it's just not who I am. And I've done sit-ups all day long. I've done all that stuff. And I still have like just four little abs, and they only show half the time. And it is what it is, you know, but that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt. Like, it still hurts because it makes you feel like you're not somehow dedicated enough. But yeah, like you said, so much of that is genetics. I trained with Shalane Flanagan for a while, and she has like 50 abs, you know, they're just like, or Emma Coburn. And
yes,
and that's, and it's like, I'll never look like either of them, but I look like me. Mm-hmm. And I am fine with the way I look, you know, like I bumped into an old competitor of mine the other day at my son's track meet. She's like, I recognize you from across the track. I saw those legs, I saw those quads, you know, and like, that's just that's how I look. And it is really harmful when people tell you that, because you can't change your body, like you can't change it. That's the body you were born with. So you should be focusing on the things about you that are unique, that make you strong and fast and powerful, and not the things that you don't have that honestly don't matter.
Absolutely. And I've said this before, but I beat a lot of people with six packs in my day, and it doesn't matter. It really doesn't. If you're taking care of your body, if you're putting in the work, if you're putting in the fuel, you're going to be the best version of yourself as an athlete and a person. And that's going to look different than somebody else's best version of themselves. And
totally.
It's hard to wrap your mind around that mentally, especially when you're confronted with that a lot in your environment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough, but you got to know you have your own gifts, you know, whatever they may be.
Yeah. So while you were within Nike Oregon Project, tell us a little bit about that culture around food. Kind of what were you seeing in that environment, and especially coming from coaching staff?
It was just a lot of judgment on what you were eating. I hated going to camp. I loved going to camp because I like the isolation. I like the, like, we are just here to train and like no distractions. Mm-hmm. But I also hated going to camp because my husband and I would be in a condo with our coach, and everything I ate, whether it was like toast in the morning, everything is like noted, mentioned. And then for dinner, it's like, you're eating all of that, comments like that. And then at one point, my coach even brought in another coach to make me food, and I was starving. Like, that's when I was like in my room. I'm a grown woman. I eat what this coach cooks for me. And then I'm in my room, like, eating power bars and like cookies, 'cause I'm starving still, you know? And so it was just really hard. And again, it's one thing if like a nutritionist is brought in and that person is helping me, hey, this, you need this and you need that. But instead it was just like random. Like, you know, one time we went and we all had a great meet, a track meet, and we went to, the coach chose to take us to Red Robin. Okay. Mm-hmm. The coach took us there. And then we all go to order burgers, and he's like, you guys are ordering burgers? You're going to destroy everything you just did. Mm-hmm. So we all switched our order to chicken burgers, but it's not any different, you know?
Just less iron.
Yeah, actually, it's actually worse because we just worked hard and we needed the iron. So it's just like stuff like that when people don't have any knowledge, but it's still really damaging. And I was like nervous to get caught eating certain things. And I mean, Adam and I had like a whole drawer in our room at the condo that was like filled with food, which is like crazy to say out loud, but we did. We had like a drawer of food that we could eat where we wouldn't be judged.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, I think there's this mentality, as I'm sure you know, where it's like you have to look like you need to look a certain way and this and that, but without the actual knowledge behind what you actually need to fuel yourself properly, you're just spewing something that you don't even know. Mm-hmm. And saying, if you lost 5 pounds, you run faster is like so crazy because you don't even know what I weigh right now.
Right.
And what am I going to lose in that 5 pounds? Like maybe I'm going to lose my power, mm-hmm. you know? So it's just, he would just spew off random things like that. And you know what? As much as I suffered, my teammate suffered much more. Amy Begley suffered much more than me. Mm-hmm. And it really had a damaging effect on her. And it stole the love of running from her and all sorts of stuff. And for what? I mean, she made an Olympic team
right. When
he told her she couldn't because she was too big. And then she did. So she mm-hmm. obviously wasn't too big. And yes. She was so small. Yeah. But anyway, it was terrible. And you just feel like you're trapped in these positions. Like, yeah, I was an adult, but I was sponsored by Nike and he was paid by Nike and we're working out at Nike and you just feel like you can't question or stand up to him. So like I said, I'm like saying yes and doing what he wants. And then behind the scenes, I'm eating in my room at 8 o'clock at night because I'm like, I can't go to bed. I'm hungry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just so hard to constantly be like policing yourself in these different environments and, you know, hearing those comments and, you know, still trying to do what's best for you. But of course, they're going to get to you to some degree
right. And
they're going to get into your head. And, you know, seeing teammates struggle and that control around food is a big thing with toxic and abusive coaching environments. I would say to any athlete who's listening, if you are like, huh, that sounds kind of familiar, good idea to zoom out and kind of dig into that a little bit more, because controlling food intake is a big one with coaches who are abusive. And like you said, it's not coming from knowledge.
No.
It's not coming from a background in nutritional sciences. 5 pounds is an arbitrary number. There is zero research that says losing 5 pounds across the board for every person is going to make you faster.
Right.
That's not true. And like you said, that 5 pounds could be muscle and it could make you slower or it could make you injured. And it is really arbitrary. And without that knowledge to back up that advice, it's just bad advice and very controlling.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was, looking back, it's like crazy that I lived in that situation. But I'm grateful that I never, like, I did restrict myself in front of him, but I didn't restrict myself for good, you know,
yeah.
And I think it's because I had that experience and I was training so much more and I was running so well. Mm-hmm. I was like, I know I'm not overweight. I know I'm not, you know, I know I'm doing everything. I'm working so hard. Like So in front of you, I'm going to say, okay, and I'm going to only have the small bowl of pasta, but then when you leave, I'm going to have more, or I'm going to go in my room to my snack drawer.
Yes, which thank God you had the snack drawer because you had an incredible career despite all of that going on. And I know one of the kind of breaking points for you, and it is hard in the elite world, the professional world, where you do feel kind of controlled by brands and you are sort of forced into these boxes. You're forced to stay within groups or coaches that may not be the best for you because you're getting paid by this brand who's keeping you there. You know, a big breaking point for you was when you had your son and had a very short timeline to return to running. So tell us a little bit about what it was like for you running through pregnancy in that environment and what was expected of you for the return.
You know, running through the pregnancy, I was expected to be at the track at first and I was doing hard workouts and stuff. But then I suffered like a sacral reaction, and honestly it was like the best thing because then he let me just train on my own. And I actually loved running when I was pregnant. I loved it so much. I would just like go run around. I like saw houses I've run by 1,000 times and never noticed. I was running on trails. I mean, it's kind of funny. The day I went into labor, I ran this run that I could have sworn was probably like 8 miles. And then I went and ran it after I gave birth and it's like 5 miles. but I actually enjoyed running while I was pregnant because it became mine and it was like time with him. But the return was, you know, I was expected back at practice about a week. Well, I started running a week after he was born and I was expected back at practice about 10 days after he was born. And I was not even close to being healed. I mean, Yeah, I don't know how much information you want, but like I wore
as much as you want.
A diaper for months because I was not healed, and then I'm pounding and I couldn't, you know, I was just like losing so much blood and all this stuff, and I developed this hip issue, which I still deal with to this day. And I got through, like, I ran Boston, the Boston Marathon, when Colt was 6.5 months. And it looked on paper like this huge success. I got fifth and I ran 2:24, but I was in pain the whole time. I was miserable. I stopped nursing Colt at like 4 months because I just physically couldn't handle the training and the nursing. Like my own doctor was like, something has to give. Like, either you need to scratch from Boston or you need to stop nursing because you are asking way too much of your body. You're running 120 miles a week and nursing your son. Like, this is a recipe for disaster. And there were so many, again, like back when I was in college, there were so many consequences after that. Like, Boston was in April. In June, I make the US team for the World Championships, but then I get a femoral head, like stress fracture in the head of my femur. Mm-hmm. And it was just like so short-sighted. And I know there's been other women that did it. And my coach at the time would always say, Dara Torres did it. Well, she was a swimmer and it's not the same. Mm-hmm. and so I really, you know, looking back, there were all these magazine articles and covers about like, you can do it all. But I really regret that storyline because I wasn't doing it all. I wasn't able to nurse my son as long as I had hoped for. I wasn't enjoying my running. I was kind of just existing, and that's no way to live, you know? Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's such a hard experience to go through. And it's hard, I'm sure, to look back and feel some regret, but you were just doing the best you could in those moments. And it sounds like a lot of this pressure was coming from sponsors and coaches.
Yeah, I stopped getting paid. So that was the thing, is that I had gone to Nike ahead of time. I said, I want to have a baby. They said, don't worry about it. We're not going to cut your contract to stay relevant. By the way, I have all the receipts for this. So I'm not making this up.
Yeah.
I have all the emails and everything. And then when I was, I got pregnant and Colt was due at the end of September, and in July, I just didn't get paid. And when I went and asked them, they said, oh, well, because of your medical condition, we can't pay you.
Medical condition called life. Love that term.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it was so shocking and jarring, and I had such a good relationship with the brand, and it was just super upsetting. And so while I was coming back from having Colt, I was still fighting this battle that I was looking like I wasn't going to get paid for a year and a half, 18 months without pay. And I was like, you're putting me on the cover of magazines and you're putting me in front of all these women and saying you can do everything, but like behind the scenes, I'm not getting paid. So that was going on in the background. And essentially, like, I just had to start racing, because as soon as I started racing, the clock at least would stop. And then I was kind of told, I wasn't kind of, I was told if you win Boston, all of this will go away. Wow. So I was like, okay, I got to win Boston. But that was so unrealistic, you know, like I had to heal from having a baby and then get in shape to run a marathon. So it was super unrealistic. And at Boston, I thought I ran a phenomenal race, everything considered, but that wasn't enough. And so that wasn't enough to stop it. It was just really stressful. I never would have made those choices. I think if I had had, now the contracts are different, thank goodness. I think if someone had said, you have a year to get back to racing, I never would have run Boston. I would have like actually not started running even a week after giving birth. I would have taken more time. And I think in a weird way, it would have extended my career, because I don't think I would have had all these hip issues that I continue to have even today. And so I think that short-term success cost me maybe like 2 or 3 more years on the end of my career.
Yeah, which is, I'm sure, hard to look back on, but it's hard because it's like other moms go back to work at 4 months. It just happens for you that back to work is the most physically demanding job. And I think that's where our society in general does a real disservice to moms, and the expectation to quote unquote bounce back and get back as fast as you can and also be present, be a good mom, be there for your kid. It's so much to manage at once. And not to mention on top of that, pregnancy, postpartum, breastfeeding, most nutritionally demanding time in your life. It really is. Like, the wound in your uterus is the size of a dinner plate, and you're trying to heal from that. And then you're also building back bone density. Women lose about 5% of their bone mineral density during pregnancy and even postpartum, and it takes a while to restore. And that's when a lot of runners who come back quickly experience those major injuries like femoral neck, femoral head, which is huge. So if anyone's listening who's feeling pressure to get back, what's something that young Kara would have loved to hear? What's something that would have really helped you in that time?
I think, you know, it would have helped me for just someone to take me seriously. Like, again, I was in this program that was all men. No one had ever given birth. They had no idea. I remember saying, like, I can stick a hand in my stomach. Like, something's going on. Well, just tighten up your core, you know, focus on your core while you're lifting. But I would just say, like, take your time. I think there's this fear if you don't quickly come back, somehow you've lost everything. Look at Faith Kipyegon, right? She took a whole year, more than a year away, and then she ended up winning the Olympics multi times over. Or look at Ellie St. Pierre, who just took her time, and then in her first, like, real season back to racing, wins the world indoor title. So it's like, I think when you give yourself the ability to actually heal from having a child and work your way back in, it just becomes this couple seasons that you missed versus all the women I've seen that try to, like, force their way back like I did. And I'm not blaming us. We were doing the best we could in that moment, but we all ended up with lifelong injury cycles after that. And that's, it's not worth it. It's short term, you know, short term, like, taking care of yourself, and maybe you miss one season, but then you are healthy and you're strong. And a lot of women feel even better after they give birth, right? So you miss one more season, but now you're back and you feel amazing. And also, like, don't let a man tell you that you should be back, because they'll never understand what it feels like. And they have no idea, you know? And it's like, giving birth was very difficult. My epidural wore off. Colt was stuck. He was sunny side up. It was just not what I imagined my birthing plan to be, which was, like, very peaceful. And he comes into the world. And I needed to heal from that. And I needed to, like, take time, and I didn't. And yeah, I do regret it, but I do give myself grace. Like, I did the best I could. But if I could go back, I never would have done that. I would have taken time. I would have gone for walks. I would have waited till my body told me it was healed and ready to start building up. And it didn't cost me anything in the long term. I ended up running super fast after Colt was born, so I didn't need to prove anything to anyone right away.
Yeah, and I wish that there was more of that rhetoric around pregnancy and postpartum for moms. I would never blame a mom for trying to come back too quickly to life or work or running, because that's what we're told we need to do. And it is kind of a man's world where that's coming mm-hmm. from men who have no concept of what that's physically, emotionally, mentally like. Those hormone changes, postpartum mental health challenges are very real. And those are all things that women not only don't have resources for, but we're told to just kind of ignore it and get back to life. And you, after Nike, ended up running for Wazelle, which is a total 180, a female-owned and run company. So what was that like, going from this kind of men's world at Nike, where you're kind of swept under the rug as a pregnant athlete, to now being around other women, trying to empower women in the sport?
Yeah, when I got out of my Nike contract and I went and visited with other brands, it was kind of like a lot of the brands were very similar, just smaller. And then I went and visited Wazelle, and honestly, I was like, is this real? Like, they're so supportive. They're supportive to the women that are pregnant. They're supportive, like, in the office, like, you can bring your baby in. I remember Lauren Fleshman had gotten pregnant right after she signed. Like, they were so supportive of Steph Bruce. And I was like, is this real? Like, these women are like, they really want you to be your full self. And it just was, I mean, such an easy choice. Like, I just wanted to be a part of the team. And in fact, when I first said I wanted to come, they said no, because they were like, we can't give you what we feel like you deserve. But in the end, we worked it. I was like, I don't care. Just make me any offer. But it was so great. And I think that extended another, you know, Olympic cycle out of me. I think without Wazelle, I think I probably would have kind of quietly run my way into, you know, goodbye. But because I felt so supported and I felt so loved and I didn't feel like, oh, you have to do X, Y, Z. It was like, we want you to do what you want to do. It really extended my career. And it, you know, I didn't make that third Olympic team, but I came close. I don't think that would have happened without Wazel.
Yeah, that's amazing to have the support of other women. I think that's another huge reason why we need more women involved in the sport, in coaching, just being present for other women, because our experience is unique and it's different than our male counterparts. And not to say that men don't also go through difficult challenges, but it's just very different.
Yeah.
Considerations for starting a family, women are looking at a year plus of their body changing and giving everything to their baby. And, you know, men, while they're supportive partners, aren't going through the same changes physically. So what's one last thing you could say in terms of, you know, women in sport and pregnancy? What are some resources you would love to see women have more of?
Yeah, I think I would just shout out Allison Felix and Alicia Montano right here for really leading the way of what this looks like. So specifically getting the word maternity in sports contracts. So that's, you know, the legality of it kicks in when it says maternity. So like, for instance, my old Nike contract, it didn't say pregnancy. It didn't say maternity. It said nothing. And when I first signed with Nike, Adam asked them, hey, what happens if she gets pregnant? And they were like, why, you know?
Yeah.
And I think they've done so much work of like getting those words into the contracts, which helps protect the athlete. But I think, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things that could happen. I think the WNBA is really leading in this space as far as like providing daycare and plane tickets and care for babies. But I think we're starting to see things pop up, like Allison Felix and Alicia have had this, where there is daycare at races, where there are nursing rooms, where there are places to be. But I still think it could be better. You know, I still think there could be more support from the major races. You know, like when I had Colt, I was like, I'm not leaving him at home.
Right.
And it was a battle. It was like, I need an extra plane ticket for my mom and I need an extra hotel room so he can stay with my mom the night before the race. And it was a battle every time. And that was so surprising to me. It was like, you're paying me all this appearance money. Like, what's this extra little bit that's going to help me be better? I will be better with my child there. So I think things like that are getting better, but there's still room to grow there. But really, like, Alicia Montano and Allison Felix are really, really leading the way in this space. So you should check both of them out. They both have their own programs and they're making real change for female athletes.
They really are. And speaking of Alicia Montano's For All Mothers organization, they're doing fun runs in a lot of communities for families. So you can head to their website too and check their calendar to see if there's any races in your area. We're going to be having one actually out here in LA at a new location in Santa Monica Heartbreak Hill Running Company, which is really fun. So yeah, thank you to you and Allison and Alicia and other women who are paving the way for younger athletes. I know what you've gone through is unfair, unjust, and there's a lot of hurt there, but we're very appreciative for all the advocacy work that you have done to make it better for the rest of us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And I know there was some heartbreak there with Wazel when you were in, you know, 2016, trying to qualify for the Olympics. You finished fourth at the Olympic trials, which fourth is probably one of the hardest places to finish in any sport, but especially at the Olympic trials. What was that like for you?
It was really difficult. You know, I never in my mind envisioned that I would be close but not get it. I envisioned in my mind either I would be in the top three or I would be way out of it and the answer would be clear. It's time to hang up your shoes. So I think, you know, I had this plan in my mind that I would run the marathon at the Rio Olympics and then I would say goodbye to the sport. And because I didn't get that, it kind of left me with this weird feeling. So I kind of kept training for like two or three more years, but really half-heartedly, you know, like I was showing up and doing the work, but I wasn't enjoying it. And it was difficult. It's kind of like when you transition out of college, you're just sort of like, well, who am I now? Like, what am I doing? And so, yeah, finishing fourth was really hard. I mean, there were so many nights where I would just lie there and think about the race and think about where I let time go. It's just sort of a haunted place, but you know, it is what it is, and that's what happened. So I had to eventually just move forward. But I did have a few years where I kind of struggled with, who am I now? What's my identity? What's my purpose if I'm not making teams? Like, what is my value now that I'm not making teams? And so that was its own little thing I had to work through you know, in life.
Absolutely. It's so hard to go through those transitional periods and feel lost. And again, I think we maybe anticipate it in college or after college, but it's really hard to go through that in your 30s and your 40s and just feel like you should have things figured out and you don't. And that's really hard. And you've also been really open about your struggle fairly recently with repetitive exercise dystonia. I know you were recently diagnosed with that within the last couple years. So how has your relationship with running evolved, and what is running to you now?
You know, what's funny is I still love it so much. And I think it's because it was such a pure way to begin the sport. And I can't run as much as I want. I have to really be in tune with my body. Like, I work for NBC. So like when I'm working a lot, my dystonia is worse because my nervous system is fried. Mm-hmm. And so I have to just like give myself grace and only jog 1 or 2 miles during like when I'm working a lot or something like that. But then I will catch times where it's pretty good. And then I try to take advantage of that. But I just really love running. And I, you know, I hopped in a 5K in Boston in April, really just to help my son navigate a mass start. And then I was like, I'll just run whatever after he goes. And I ended up running with, of all people, Lisa Montano, and ended up running. Yeah. And I ended up running because she dragged me faster than I thought. And so then I actually just entered another 5K for next month. So I'm like, well, maybe I could run under 19 minutes if I actually like prepare. So I still love running so much. It looks very different, but I have to say, like, I still love it just as much. And I feel really lucky about that. Like, I, you know, if I run 3 or 4 miles after I drop Colt off at school, I just feel whole. And I'm never going to run 100 and, you know, I used to run up to 135 miles a week. I'm never going to do that again. I'm going to probably, you know, I've run like between 20 and 40 miles a week, depending on how my dystonia is. But it's not about how far I go or what the workout looks like. It's like just connecting with myself. So I still really, really love running. It's still a huge part of my life.
That's so inspiring. I just love hearing the full circle, how running started for you, and that's where you are with it now. And that's so special to be able to have that piece of you that's so important. And now you get to share it with Colt, your son, who we just talked about is going to high school, which is insane. I remember when he was playing on the pole vault mats when I was at CU and he was so little. So crazy. But now that you are the mom of a runner, what would be some advice you can give for, you know, a mom of a young athlete? How can you best support them in their relationship with food, with running, and give them that time and space to figure it out on their own?
Yeah, I think, like, you know, it has to be their journey. I think as parents, we want to make our kids' lives easier and great, but like really Colt has to decide that he wants to run. I love that he runs, but it can't be me making him run. And it can't be, Adam and I had our own journeys in running and we got to go all the way to the Olympics, but we didn't have a parent that was like pushing us and driving us. You know, we got to choose it every step of the way. And so I really want that for him. And I just want to remind parents, like, it is fun when your kids start doing something you love. It's super fun. But remember that they get to have it be theirs, you know? And yeah, it's been interesting on this side of it because it's like, do we train Colt and see how good he is? And then we've decided, no, we're not doing that. He cannot start training until he goes to high school. And then he gets to make the decision. But it is hard. And also it's so hard watching your child. I mean, when they set a goal, he set this goal of winning this district meet last week, and I was like shaking, and I'm like, I just want him to be proud, you know? And so that has been like hugely surprising to me, is just how much I care and want him to be happy. And after every meet, I always like text my mom. I'm like, I don't know how you did this for so many years. Like, thank you for being such a good mom, because you just get involved in their dreams, you know? And then I think too, like making sure they're eating, like, especially like Colt's going through puberty, he's growing like crazy. He's grown, you know, he's almost as tall as me. So it's like making sure that they have a good relationship with food too. And I think too about like my childhood and how my mom ate totally normally. All of my siblings ate totally normally. And I want that to be modeled for him as well. Like, I don't think I've ever told him, no, you can't have that, you know, like maybe to soda at a certain point or like something with caffeine. But I'm kind of like, I don't ever want him to think there's any bad food, because everything is fine in a whole diet, you know? So making sure that he doesn't have any, like, no shame around food in his life either.
That's so special that you're giving that to him. And I also love that you're making running about how he feels about it and, you know, helping him reach his goals, which feels good, whether that's running or school or life. And just creating those life skills both on the track and off the track is amazing. And again, your story has just been so inspiring. And thank you for sharing all of that. Any last words of wisdom or pieces of advice that you would like to share with anyone who might be listening?
I just think trust your gut, take care of you, you know, like you have to take care of you to take care of other people. Like if you're a mom and you're listening, like if you don't take care of yourself, then you can't really take care of your kids. And if you're a college athlete or a high school athlete, you got to just take care of yourself first. And that's not selfish. You know, you can be a better person by making sure that you are taken care of, and whether that's with food or mental health or whatever it is, but make sure you're taking care of yourself.
Such great advice. You can't pour from an empty cup. So I love that. And you sound like you are in a good place with balancing all of that. So thank you for sharing all of that. I'd love to wrap up today with our fun rapid fire questions.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Everyone's favorite. Okay. What is your go-to pre-run snack?
I do love toast. I love toast with butter or with avocado or like banana, but I do love toast. It's just easy.
Toast is probably the most popular answer. what would you pick for your last meal?
Oh, that's such a good one. Honestly, so, like I just am a sucker for guacamole. So it could be tacos. It could be nachos. I don't really care. Just as long as there's like a big thing of guacamole with it.
Guacamole themed dinner.
Yes, yes.
Love it. Okay. What is your favorite dessert?
I love baked goods. I can't bake, but I love baked stuff. But I do have, this is kind of embarrassing, but I do have a peanut M&M addiction. Like, I don't know why they've never sponsored me, because I have to have them almost every single day of my life for probably the last 18 years or something. So they're just easy, simple. You can get them everywhere. I love them.
Wow. Your move, peanut M&Ms.
Yeah, seriously.
What is your least favorite food?
My least favorite food. There's not a lot of food that I don't like. I don't like ham very much.
Interesting.
And like really, I hate bacon. Okay. I know it's a texture thing.
Yeah.
And then I don't really like ham, period. I don't like pork. Okay. I'll eat it, but I really avoid it if I can.
Interesting. Ham, that's a first. if you could travel anywhere in the world for a food experience, where would you go?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think I would just like to go back to like the Mediterranean. I just love like the olive oil and the bread and the fresh tomatoes. So probably somewhere like Italy or Croatia, something like that in the Mediterranean.
Yum. I love tapas and Mediterranean food. RIP yes. The Med in Boulder.
Yes. Seriously. So sad.
So sad. What is your go-to lazy meal as someone who enjoys cooking?
Okay. I have a couple. One is like, I'll make this chicken tortellini soup and it's like so easy and you don't have to do anything if you buy the pulled chicken. And then I also will make pasta when I'm like, really, I'm just not feeling it. And I just like saute up some meat and then just do the noodles. Yeah.
That's one of mine too.
Yeah.
Awesome. And last question, what is your favorite coffee or tea drink?
I love a latte. That's always my order. On Mother's Day, the boys were like, what do you want? And I was like, I just want a latte. Go get me a latte.
So do with you whole flavors milk, or
no, unflavored? Just a plain latte with whole milk. I really love it. I drink coffee at home, but I try to get a latte a couple days a week. It just feels like I love it. And it's like a treat.
Yeah. It's the best.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Kara. Where can people keep up with you if they would like to?
Probably just Instagram is where I post the most. So at Kara Goucher there.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much, Kara. And we will be excited to hear more from you on NBC.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode of the Fueling Forward podcast. If you'd like to keep up with Kara Goucher, you can do so on Instagram at Kara Goucher. Next week's episode will be a Q&A with me, your host, Maddie Alm. If you'd like to submit a question to be answered on air, you can do so on my website at www.fuelingforward.com under the podcast tab, or you can send me an email at fuelingforwardpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you at the next Fueling Forward Friday.